bias against people of different colour, bias against different genders, different abilities, sexualities and so on, it may not affect us personally. Not only do we have a business imperative, but we have a moral responsibility. Because if we are going to really work for this fair society that we all believe in, we have to make sure that each and every one of the people in our community are catered for. And the fact that we have lenses and ways of seeing the world isn't something that disadvantages others.
That's Yasmin Abdul-Majid, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Yasmin Abdul-Majid on recognizing bias. We all almost automatically think of ourselves as somehow evolved and enlightened and free from bias. Hey, I look at someone and judge that person on the merits of his or her character. Race, class, gender, age, sexual orientation, geographical origin, accent don't factor in at all. We might be kidding ourselves to think we are free from prejudice. Cognitive shortcuts based on negative stereotypes can cause problems when we are unaware of them and can lead to wrong decisions and discriminatory practices. Take, say, for example, the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. All the same? Hardly. But the media are not into subtleties. They need simple descriptions. Muslims are like this. Islam is like that. Bias tends to be deep and requires work to identify and root out. Recognition is the first step in eliminating bias. Our guest today is Yasmin Abdul-Majid. She's a leading voice for recognizing bias and resisting cultural appropriation. She was born in Sudan and grew up in Australia, where she trained as a mechanical engineer. She now works as an engineering specialist on oil and gas rigs, as well as heading up Youth Without Borders, the organization she founded to enable young people to work for positive change in their communities. She was named 2015 Queensland Young Australian of the Year. She spoke in Ottawa at the convention of the National Union of Public and General Employees, one of Canada's largest trade unions. After her lecture, I had a chance to sit down with her for an interview. And now, Yasmin Abdul-Majid.
Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather, which, as I understand, are the unceded Algonquin territory. And I like to do that because in Australia we have a similar tradition of acknowledging the traditional owners, and I think it's important that we remember the land on the people that we gather and the fact that we come not, I suppose, without history. So, what am I going to talk to you about today? I'm going to talk to you about a concept called unconscious bias. Why should we care about bias? What is it exactly? How does it play out in the world? And then what can we do about it? I'm going to tell you a little story. And you may have heard it before. So if you have, don't tell the person next to you the answer. But it goes a little something like this. There was a young man and his father, a young boy and his father, cruising around on the highway, breakneck speed, right? Really, really fast, and they get into an awful car accident. The father dies on impact, and the young boy is severely injured. They rush the young boy to hospital, and when they get the young boy into the surgery, the surgeon looks at the boy and is like, "I can't operate." Why? "The boy is my son." And often people are like, "Oh, how can that be? The father just died." Ladies and gentlemen, the surgeon is his mother. Now, hands up if the first thing you thought of was that the surgeon was a man. Now, that is unconscious bias. It's the fact that we see the world through certain lenses. And the question then becomes, if we have these expectations of things, if we see the world through certain lenses, how does that play out? Take an example, a fictitious example, of a guy named John and a guy named Jerome. Jerome is African-American, and John is Anglo-Saxon, and they both have osteoarthritis in their knee, and they both go to the same doctor. They both have similar insurance policies and so on. But the doctor happens to share a similar background to John. And so when John tells him what's going on, the doctor decides, well, you know what? I think I should recommend you a knee replacement surgery. But with Jerome, the doctor's implicit bias, or the doctor's unconscious bias, says, well, I haven't really dealt with many people like Jerome before. And I'm not really sure if Jerome is going to follow the treatment the same way that I would expect him to. So rather than offer a knee replacement, I'm going to tell him to lose some weight and do a bit more exercise. And also, and this is a science has shown that people tend to what they call superhumanize African Americans and blacks in particular. They assume that Jerome is in less pain because they're like, well, he can handle more pain. What happens is John goes on in life, gets a knee replacement surgery, and Jerome gets more and more upset because he's in more pain. And he doesn't understand, or the doctor that he's talking to doesn't relate to him. Fast forward another 10 years, and John's had a knee replacement. However, he's having some trouble because he's lost his job. And so he goes back to the doctor, gets a therapist, and the therapist talks to him about a number of things, and because they're from similar backgrounds, they can relate to each other. Jerome also goes back to the doctor 10 years later, but he's in a very different position. He's in a position where he's had a decade of pain because his original doctor didn't listen to him. And when he gets allocated a therapist, the therapist says, well, you should have listened to your doctor. You should have lost some weight. And then Jerome's in a situation where he believes that his therapist isn't going to listen to him. He falls into more and more depression. And he goes in a completely different path. Now, this may seem like a really exaggerated example, but research has shown that some of the biases of people in the health service mean that people get treated in different ways. And it's not to say that people are discriminatory. And often our what we believe that we do is very different from what our unconscious does. But it's about pointing out that sometimes we treat people differently and things happen differently because of the lenses through which we see the world. Another example, Lauren and Layla. They both go to the same school. But Layla is someone that the teacher doesn't quite know how to... She's from Sri Lanka, and the teacher has never really dealt with a Sri Lankan student before. And so when Lauren and Layla get their results back, for example, at school, the report cards are the same, but Layla has less kind of corrective markers on hers, right? Because the teacher's like, well, I'm not really sure where this person's going to go in life. And unconsciously, the teacher has put in less effort into Layla's results. And then a couple of years later, there's graffiti at the school. And both Lauren and Layla get pulled into the principal's office. And Lauren says, well, I was with my parents watching TV when the incident happened. And she's in question again. And Layla says, well, I was cooking for my parents because, you know, I was taking care of my family that afternoon. But because of the implicit bias of the person asking the questions, Layla gets pulled in again. And the students that get shortlisted to be questioned further are all students of color. Because implicitly, the principal associates students of color with criminality. Because that's all they've ever seen, potentially. And so Layla again gets reinforced, well, even though you might have been doing the right thing, I'm going to assume that you may be liable. Or I'm going to assume that you may be at fault. Now, at the end of the day, Layla doesn't get charged or she doesn't get in trouble for it because she didn't do anything. But if time and time and time and time and time again, you are told that maybe it is your fault, how does that play out? And so why should we care about bias? That's like a ridiculous amount of information. But we can only cognitively process about 40. So we make all these shortcuts. And what ends up happening is 90% of the way that we make our decisions is unconscious. We only consciously make about 10% of decisions, right? But the problem then becomes if some of the information is flawed, then how do we make sure those decisions are right, those decisions are rational? All right, here's another question. Who thinks they tend to make ethical decisions? By and large, some of you are like, I'm not too sure. Research has shown, and this is, I remember reading this and being like, oh, mate, the struggle. Research has shown that those that think they make ethical decisions tend to be the ones that don't. So the people that didn't put your hands up, well done. The more ethical we think we are, the less ethical our decisions tend to become. Now, why is that? It's because, particularly in times of high stress, we go back to making decisions based on shortcuts. And they tend to be decisions based on what we're familiar with, rather than necessarily what is best for, you know, or what is most objective. And it's a hard thing, right? It's, the reality is, I talk a lot about unconscious bias, and I also suffer from, you know, all those different lenses. And it's about constantly, like, checking ourselves and making sure that, you know, we're calling ourselves out. And are you guys aware of the concept called microaggressions, or the term microaggressions? Essentially, microaggressions are like the small things that happen in our language and in life that kind of frame the way we see the world, right? So, for example, it's people saying things like, oh, the engineering guy, or always using he when they're referring to a leader, or saying things, well, you're not like the rest of them, really, when referring to anything. Because what it's doing is saying, well, you're part of my group now. You're not part of the group that you claim to represent. Or saying to any group of people, hey, lads, or hey, guys, or hey, fellas. These small things, or even having a hallway with all the, like, pictures of the leaders of the past, and they're all being white guys. How can any young brown girl or any young child with a disability walk through and think, oh, cruise through and think, I could be one of them, because they don't see themselves represented. You can't be what you can't see. And if you've never seen anything like you in a position of influence, in a position where they are heard, you will not expect that you will be one of those people. So there's a couple of ways that bias tends to play out, and I talked about a couple of examples, but there are, I mentioned the sort of cognitive biases. There are four in particular that I'd like to highlight. One is this kind of in-group, out-group bias. So in our brain, there's this thing called the amygdala, right? It's like the center, it's the reptilian part, it's the fight or flight mechanism. It's the one that says, we're us and they're them. It's actually, interestingly, groups like the armies and the police force have really strong in-group, out-group biases, because anyone who's within the, you know, the army or the police are the in-group, and anyone else is the out-group. And it's sometimes, it doesn't even have to be based on anything. If, for example, I played a game and I said, you guys are group A, group B, group C, and group D, and I made you play a competition against each other, all of a sudden, even if you're best mates with somebody in that group, you'll be like, mm-hmm. We are so much better than you guys, right? Based on what? Based on a really arbitrary grouping of people. And this used to be based on stuff that was useful. It used to be that you needed to, like, you know, make sure the people in your village was protected, right? Anyone who was in the outgroup could be potentially dangerous. But we live in a globalized world, and we live in a world where those rules don't really apply anymore. But in times of high stress in particular, those kind of, like, fight or flight in-group, out-group mechanisms come back. Now, the interesting part is that, yes, our brain has that kind of, like, base emotion or base decision-making skill, but we also have something called the prefrontal cortex, which is the thinking part, which is the part of our brain that sits at the front, and it can override the amygdala. So we can condition ourselves out of the in-group, out-group bias, but we have to be aware of it. Now, the second is anchoring bias, right? Where you take an example of one thing that you've seen a person from a certain group do before, and you allow it to color every single experience you have in the future. So, like, I worked with an engineer who was a girl once. She was awful. All female engineers are awful, for example. Or I once had a customer who was, I don't know, Korean. And, you know, they dealt with me really rudely. And so I'm going to think in the future that all Korean customers are rude. Whatever it is, Or, you know, I had a really bad experience with a cowboy once. Therefore, all cowboys are awful, right? Whatever it is, and no matter what, like no matter what other information we get, we take that single experience and we apply it to all of the people. And this tends to also happen in the news a lot, right? It's like this one person did something and therefore it represents everything. If you're in a marginalized group, you don't get the luxury of being treated as an individual. The third one is affinity bias, right? And that's, I suppose, similar to, say, for example, I'm walking into an interview, right? And no, there's somebody else in front of me who's walked into an interview, right? We're going to go with, his name's Carl. Carl is, loves a particular hockey team, went to a particular school, whatever it may be, walks into the interview, and there's somebody else, you know, at the interview panel, there's three guys, and all of a sudden he realizes, oh, hey, the person at the interview panel goes to the same hockey team. Oh, and another person on the interview panel, oh, we went to the same school. And the guy at the interview panel's like, oh, man, Carl reminds me of me when I was his age. He's really nervous. He stuffed that first question up. You know what I'll say to Carl? Carl, it's all good, dude. Just calm down a little bit. Take a deep breath and try again. Carl takes a deep breath, tries again, and does really, really well. Because the person on the interview panel's like, hey, I see a little bit of myself in this guy. And then I walk into the room. I don't know anything about hockey. Never been to the schools. Never even heard of the schools that these guys went to. And so we don't get that opportunity to create that same rapport. And so even though Carl and I have the exact same qualifications, because we haven't had that opportunity to create that same affinity, because the people on the interview panel can't see themselves in me, I won't get that same handout. I won't get that same, you know what? You're like us. You should join us. And again, these aren't necessarily bad things, but we have to recognize that they happen, right? Because we just like people that are like us. That's how life works. We want people that are like us to surround us. But if we want the best teams, and if we want to be the most inclusive, we have to sometimes realize that we may not share the same experiences, because for the person that walks into a room and doesn't share the same experience as everybody else, how are they ever going to get an in? The last one that I'll talk about is confirmation bias. And that applies across the board. That is where we look for information to back up beliefs we already believe in. And you see it in the gun debate in the United States all the time, right? People will say, oh, well, I believe a certain thing about guns. And regardless of all the information that is opposing it, I will look at that information and apply it in a way that backs up my existing belief. We do it with so many things to confirm what we already believe in. And you may think, well, Yasmin, it's no big deal if I hire someone who's similar to me. It's no big deal if one of the things I do is slightly biased, because really, what does it matter? But we question why we don't have diversity at the top levels, why, you know, women still haven't reached 50-50 if that's what they want, and so on. 1%. If you get a 49-51 split at every level, you end up having twice as many men as CEOs, if we're looking just at gender. And 49-51 is pretty close. It doesn't take much to get a 49-51% bias. But these things add up over time. And so we have to be aware of those really kind of subtle things that are happening. There's another interesting thing. I read this and I really wanted to mention it. There is 15% of American men are over 6 feet tall, but 60% of CEOs are over 6 feet tall. 4% of American men are over 6 feet two, and 36% of American men, of CEOs, are over 6 foot two. Weird, right? What is it about tall? It's because we unconsciously apply a certain way of, like, when we think of leader, we think of men who kind of hold themselves in a certain way, regardless of if they're competent. No offense, sorry guys. this always gets me in trouble. I get a lot of dudes often after a thing being like, you know, I'm like, settle down, it's fine. This is a complete diversion, but one of my favorite quotes was, we will reach true equality when there are as many incompetent women in leadership as there are incompetent men. But it is funny, isn't it? The way we see and what we expect certain leaders to look like and to be like and to take up space, and we don't actually pay attention to whether or not they're the right person to be doing it. This is a really interesting study that came out of Australia. So the Australian National University sent out 4,000 applications, exactly the same applications. And it turned out, if you were Italian, you would have to send out 12% more applications to get the same number of callbacks. If you were Middle Eastern, 64%. But if you were Chinese, interestingly, 68%. And we're a country that reckons they're multicultural. And Chinese people are like the model migrant. But it's because people look at a name and certain images, they have certain expectations and certain biases around particular individuals. This is one of my favorite bits. So there was a study that looked at, so I did mechanical engineering at university. And there was a study, and I work in an industry that's still pretty male dominated. I was the first female they hired in my department in Australia, which is hilarious because it was 2012. Thank you. And I remember my boss at the time asking me if I needed specialist equipment. I was like, coveralls with more booty space. I'm not quite sure what you mean. And then my first crewmate was like, you know, we're on our way to our first job, and he sort of looked really concerned. He was like, are you going to be able to carry the tools? I was like, mate, you're a Filipino man half my size. I could carry you. Like, how are we having this conversation? Good times. All right. So, how are the ways that gender is dealt with in the engineering world? The first is that it's amplified. It's this concept of a woman walking into a room, then someone would be like, no more swearing, guys. There's a woman. And me being like, mate, have you heard me? Firstly. But secondly, the thing is, right, that could have come out of some great intention. The person wants to make me feel more welcome, potentially. But what it does is it amplifies my difference. It says, here is someone who is not part of us. Here is someone who we have to change our behavior to accommodate. And so rather than maybe having a conversation with me in a separate area, being like, hey, you know, how do you feel about the kind of language that gets used? And then having a separate conversation with the lads being like, you know, we have to be aware of this, whatever, and doing it in a way that's much more inclusive. It's like, all right, guys, here's something different. Let's accommodate and let's make sure that we all recognize that this is something different. The second is that gender is used to impose gendered expectations. And it plays out in two ways. One is people only seeing a woman in the role of being either a mother or a wife, right? So being at work and having people be like, well, you know, shouldn't you be at home with your kids? Or when are you going to have kids? Sorry, one of the guys at work, I rocked up to the rig floor and he was like, you hear that ticking sound, Yasmin? I'm like, what's that? He's like, it's your biological clock. Oh, no. I was like, mate, my clock's just fine. But it's the fact that the role that they see a woman in is one of being a mother or a wife. And you would never hear somebody saying that to a guy, or it definitely doesn't happen with the same kind of weight that it does a woman. And the second thing that happens when we're talking about gendered expectations is the idea that the woman is the one that is meant to care. So it's the fact that the women may always be the one that organizes the birthday gifts or the cakes or whatever it may be, and they may want to do it, but the assumption that the woman is the one that's going to do it is what is dangerous. Because people assume, well, oh, the guy's maybe not going to do a good job, or you know, he might forget. And maybe he will. But it's the assumption, because that again reinforces, well, there is a particular role you play in our society, and you're not allowed to play outside that. The third thing that happens is that the individual is tuned out. And this happens all the time. It's this idea that I may be at a meeting, I may be the only woman, or there may be me and another girl, another female. And the woman says an idea, and it's not actually heard. And then a guy will repeat it maybe 5 minutes later, and everyone's like, mate, great idea. It happens. And the thing is, women do it to each other as well, right? It's not something that only men do. But it's the fact that somehow we expect authority to be the voice of a man. Whether rightly or wrongly, that is what our brains expect. And so we have to make sure that we are becoming aware of these things. And the fourth is this idea of like doubting technical ability. It's the fact that, you know, female engineers, no matter what their seniority, will quite often have to have a guy back their idea up before someone will be like, oh yeah, we should do that. I remember I was a field engineer and I'd been on the job for a couple of years, and there was one particular, there was a piece of information that had changed and I was aware of it, right? And I was telling that to everyone in the team, and legitimately, not only did no one believe me, but they went and asked the rig next door, right? Because they were like, no, that can't be right. Let's ask the guys next door. Let's call town. They spent half a day. And in the end, they came back and they were like, oh, you were right. And I'm like, yeah, I know I was right. I could have told you that a day ago. But for whatever reason, again, it comes back to what we expect authority to look like. So the reality becomes is that women are visible as women, and I'm talking about engineering in particular because that's my personal experience, but we're invisible as engineers, and it takes us quite a lot of time to become visible as engineers. So there's a number of ways that people use to cope, right? There are internal and external ways. So internally, women will often say, they'll either justify it to themselves, they'll be like, well, this is the way the industry is, I'll have to just acclimatize, I'll have to assimilate, right? And they'll be like, oh, well, you know, he's 68 years old. It's fine that he slapped me on the bum. Mm-mm, no. But we will justify it to ourselves. Externally, what tends to happen is women will either work so hard as to prove themselves beyond any doubt, so work 10 times as hard, or they'll professionalize themselves to the point where you don't actually get the opportunity to have that personal relationship. It becomes about purely professional, because that is the way that women have found is the most effective to be able to operate. And it's tricky, right? It's tricky because I walked onto the rigs as a 21-year-old and I didn't know what the rules were. There was no handbook for how to be a chick on a rig, right? And so I had to figure these things out. I had to make a lot of mistakes. I had to learn how to banter. And it's funny because in Australia, there was a study done in the Australian Army that showed that the one way, and I don't know if it's like this in Canada, but the one way or the one common denominator for whether people did or did not integrate well within a team was their ability to banter. And the other interesting thing is that being aware of somebody, of your own biases, doesn't always actually mean that anything will change. In fact, for some people, being aware of their biases reinforces them, because they're like, yeah, I am biased, because it's true. And I'm like, nah, mate. But what do we do about it?
You're listening to Yasmin Abdul-Majid, Recognizing Bias. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What do we do about it? And so a couple of the ways that I'm going to talk to you about at the individual level and then also at the institutional level. Because I think it's important to realize that the discrimination and the inequality that we see happens individually but also institutionally. Individually, the first and easiest thing, and if there's anything that you take away from today, is to call it out. To call it out when you see it. And now that I've told the guys at work this, they call it out all the time. They're like, Yasmin, check your bias. It's real funny watching a bunch of guys be like, Anyway. But if you see, you know, one of the female members of your team say an idea and somebody repeat it and get the credit, say, hey, Janet, that was a great idea. Or if next time somebody says, well, you know, the engineering guy or whatever it may be uses language that's slightly biased, just point it out. I will always use they when I refer to examples of people, unless the name is very specific. Because I don't want to necessarily say that someone should or shouldn't be a certain gender or any gender at all. Now, it's not easy, right? It's not easy. It means that we constantly have to be thinking about it. But that is the responsibility we take on if we want to make the world a better place, right? We are the people that set the example. We are the people that say, yeah, it's harder, but that's how we make change. I remember having a conversation with my mom, and she was like, Yasmin, you could have gotten a decent job and just, like, you know, did your 9 to 5 and had dinner with the girls and lived a lovely life. But that's not the decision you made about what you want to do. So accept the fact that it's going to be more difficult, but accept the fact that that also means that you will have an impact. But call it out. And it's not always easy. And I will say this. Also pick your battles. Because you don't necessarily have to call out every single thing you see, because people will stop talking to you, right? I've been there. But if there's something that's happened, you can take the opportunity to take someone aside and say, hey, when you said that, this is how it played out. Or maybe we should think about things differently. And be gentle. Because this is a difficult area. To say to someone, I think actually you're biased in this area, is a tough thing to do. So be gentle. And I would also recommend there's something called the implicit association test, right? If you look it up, it's the IAT. It's a test that's been done by almost 20 million people in the world. It's a very quick test online. And what it does is it'll give you a score. And it's really, essentially, you can do it around different races, different genders, different so on. And it'll show you what associations you have with certain genders and races and so on. I did the test, and I was overwhelmingly, and this frightened me because I'm a female drilling engineer, I associated caring and homemaker roles with women. And that's because the world I grew up in, even though I am challenging the norm for myself, the world I grew up in still said that that what was okay. And so it was interesting to have that highlighted to me because it meant that I'm constantly, unconsciously challenging my own expectations of what is right and what is okay. But it's interesting to do the test because then you become more aware of how you see the world. So I highly recommend it. Institutionally, it's a lot more difficult. But we have an amazing opportunity in this room because a lot of us play roles in institutions. And there's this concept called nudging that's really powerful. And what nudging is, it's kind of like setting a system up so that it becomes easier to do a good thing, right? It's not necessarily punishing or forcing or creating an incentive, but it's just making life a bit easier to do the right thing. The first one is the quite simple thing, and hopefully what we're doing today, which is creating a feel the need nudge. And that just means to create something where people start to feel the need to make a difference, right? So it's saying to the men in this room, for example, if you have a daughter, would you like your daughter to definitely have a less chance in life because of the fact that she's a woman? And that realization, creating a need for something to change. The second one is the one I'm more interested in, though. It's about how you change the system, right? And so what it's about, it's looking at, right, where are the disadvantages happening? And often in businesses, it is around employment. So, right, what at the employment level, at what level are we having biases be introduced? Is it people applying? Or are we getting the right kinds of people applying? Is it then at the selection process? Should we, like, take people's names out? I'm not sure if you may or may not have heard of the orchestra blind auditioning. For those who haven't heard, in the 50s and 60s, right, orchestras were mainly men. And people used to think it was because men played music better, of course. What they then did was they did blind auditions. So they essentially put a wall between the people, the auditioners, and the kind of examiners. They didn't see a discernible difference, right, until they made the auditioners take their shoes off. Because the clickety-clack of the heels on the ground gave the genders of the people away. And so when it became purely blind auditioning, the numbers changed dramatically. And there was like a 50% increased chance that the women would make it, you know, to the third audition, and it increased the number of women in the orchestra multiple times. And so now where orchestras around the world are almost 50-50. And that's because we looked at where in the systems the bias are being introduced and we removed that. And I really like this example of saying, for example, when you have an interview panel, when you have a selection panel for anything, everyone be really honest. Sit down at the table as interviewers and say, hey, I have a bias against this and this and this, and I'm aware of it. I prefer people who've gone to this school. You know, I've traditionally hired people who are from this area and who share my background. I will often say to people, like personally, I have a bias towards young women who are doing things that are, you know, in STEM areas. Or I will have a bias towards young people of color, young people with disability, because I feel like they don't usually get a chance. But being aware of that, because that can color my way of approaching an interview, and being really honest about that, having that discussion as a panel, and then at the end of the interview process saying, okay, how did that go? Were we able to mitigate our biases? And if I'm making a suggestion and somebody says, hey, Yasmin, I think you're doing that because of this bias, being willing to take that on. It's about being really, really honest and looking at our processes and where blockages are happening and removing them. The third is framing and anchoring, right? And it's a simple thing. It's how do we frame things? So rather than say, for example, an easy one is when it comes to statistics, put the majority in the front. So rather than saying there are 5% women in engineering, say there are 95% men in engineering. That's like, oh, it seems a lot more significant. And so we've framed the situation differently. And so it's about when looking at talking about inclusion, how do we frame it in a way that's going to change people's perspectives? This is really interesting. It's the fact that studies have shown that diverse teams perform better, but they feel like they perform worse. So if you're in a diverse team, or people have done sort of surveys on people that have been in diverse teams, and they've found that people feel less confident about the outcome that the diverse team has come out with, and they feel less confident that they've performed well, even though objectively they've performed better. It's because it's uncomfortable. It's because we're not used to it. It's because the fact that working with people that are very different from very different backgrounds will cause more friction. But you will be better. And relying on that and believing in that and holding the faith is incredibly important. And I really wanted to say this because I don't want you to feel guilty. Talking about bias, particularly unconscious bias, is not about saying everyone is terrible. You're all wrong. No. It's about saying that these things are happening, and they're happening because the world has changed so quickly. 50, 100 years ago, women weren't even in the workforce. 50, 100 years ago, I would probably have been a slave. So the world is so different. It's incredibly different, and our unconscious minds just haven't caught up with that. So it's okay to feel uncomfortable, and it's okay to feel challenged. But then our responsibility is to take that up and say, how do we make sure that our unconscious isn't running the show? And I'll leave you with this. Never underestimate the impact that you as a single individual can have. Yes, we're talking about, you know, I'm talking about, and everybody here is talking about some enormous problems in society. And it can feel overwhelming. Often we can say, well, how am I as a single individual going to make any difference? We all know that it is a small group of committed people that have changed the world in so many situations. And the reality is, I am here where I am today speaking to you because I have had single individuals offer me opportunities and open doors for me that would never have happened any other way. And you don't have to change the entire world. Even if you change the world of the people around you, even if you change the world of one human, you have had an impact in the world, and that is something to be treasured. So never underestimate the impact that you can have, and never let anybody's expectations of what is possible limit what you believe is possible. Because with that, things truly will change. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, most people in North America, we're speaking in Canada right now, know little about Australia beyond koalas and kangaroos and tennis stars, and maybe they've heard of Ayers Rock or have seen a picture. But what's going on? We're hearing incredible stories about asylum seekers enduring horrific conditions in Australia.
Yeah, it is really, it's disappointing. You know, I think what's happening in Australia is a reflection of what's happening really around the world in the West. Pushes from, I guess, right-wing groups around quite anti-immigration, anti-sort of inclusion policies, and the asylum seeker debate, or really the asylum seeker policies that have become bipartisan, unfortunately, I think epitomize that in Australia. Essentially, what's happened is there was an influx, or there have, you know, naturally, as the way the world has sort of shifted, more and more people are really looking for refuge around the world, and Australia had a couple of years of an increased intake of refugees coming on boats from Indonesia and so on. And instead of welcoming them with open arms, it became a lever for the current LNP or the current coalition to sort of say, well, this is not okay. We want to control our borders. We will stop the boats. And they came in really on this big platform of stopping the boats. And now what has happened is that we've got this really, it's a terrible policy of locking asylum seekers up in essentially infinite detention or just unknown amounts of time on Manus Island and Nauru in conditions that, you know, Amnesty International and other international agencies have said are worse than, you know, third world developing nation sort of situations. And essentially what the Australian government has done is said that we're doing this to stop deaths at sea, which is just a cloak for saying that, you know, we are pandering to the anti-immigration elements of society. I mean, it's a really long-winded way of saying Australia is a reflection of what's happening around the world, which is people becoming increasingly isolationist, increasingly less tolerant and less accepting. And it makes me really sad because I think people are responding to a couple of things. And these are my personal opinions, I guess. You know, we've got an increasingly globalized world where inequality is incredibly high. You know, across the world, we see this kind of you can have it all, but really you can have it only applies to a very small percentage of the world's population. And so the rest of, you know, members of society are like, particularly in the West, are like, well, okay, this isn't the bargain that we signed up for. And they're looking for answers. And the answer that's being given to them is, well, the problem is not the system. It's not the fact that we've got, and again, my personal opinions, you know, unfettered drive for growth, and we've got remnants of a global financial crisis where nothing's actually changed, all these sorts of things. No, the problem is not the system. The problem is the immigrants. The problem are the people that look different. And that has become, I guess, the I mean, we see it in the way that Muslims are talked about around the world and in the sort of Islamophobia and so on. It's become the flashpoint, really, and part of, I think, a struggle that we're going to see play out over the next couple of years.
And Islam is packaged as a one-size-fit-all religion. Here you have 1.5 billion people speaking languages ranging from Urdu to Pashto Bangla, Arabic. Incredible diversity from the southern Philippines to Morocco.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's part of the reason that for me Islam is such a beautiful religion. You know, it's talked about, you know, it kind of holds the vessel, the shape of the vessel which it's in, or, you know, it's like a river, it's like water in a riverbed. What you will see is the color of the riverbed itself, not the water or not the Islam. I mean, for me, Islam is a religion that fits, as you said, almost, it allows for people to continue their own culture. It allows for people to continue their practices and to continue feeling proud of who they are. All it is it's like a guidebook, in my opinion, for how to live a good life, you know, like so many other religions. But what has happened is that it has become a very convenient scapegoat, I suppose, or as I say to some people, you know, one day I was a brown girl that wore funny clothing and then I became the face of all evil. Right. And that is what we're seeing today, is we're seeing around the world people saying, well, no, Islam is the problem. And my question then is, if we keep telling people that Islam is the problem, how do we think that things are going to fix themselves? We're not listening to each other.
Is there racial profiling of Muslims in Australia?
I would be remiss to say that there isn't. I'm very reluctant. And it's interesting that you ask this at this time, because I've just come out of a week of quite interesting news, quite an interesting media cycle, actually. So I attended an iftar with the Prime Minister. And it was the first iftar the Prime Minister has ever held at Kirribilli House, the residence of the Prime Minister.
This is the breaking of the Ramadan fast.
So, yeah, iftar is the breaking of fast at the end of the day on one of the days of Ramadan. And, you know, it was quite a historic moment, because it was a very public acknowledgement of the fact that Muslims were going through Ramadan. It was, you know, the Prime Minister sort of opening his doors, and it was very welcoming, and I think it was something that I was really proud to be part of. But the backlash from not only the wider Australian public, but within the Muslim community was enormous. Within the Muslim community, people were saying, well, how dare you sit with a man and with a government that is responsible for the raiding of young Lebanese Muslim guys' homes, you know, under the suspicion of, and never actually being charged? How can you sit next to someone who treats asylum seekers the way they're currently treated, particularly because, you know, they're brown and they tend to be Muslim? How can, you know, you sit with a government whose language around Muslims has been so toxic? So, yes, there is definitely a sentiment within the Australian Muslim population that the government, I mean, Malcolm Turnbull, the current Prime Minister, has definitely been better than our previous Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who essentially said, you either choose to be on Team Australia or you don't. And, I mean, there's no two ways about it. And it's language that, you know, it was around you have to sort of assimilate, or, you know, Islamic leaders need to apologize and mean it. You know, things like this that are just nonsensical. You know, from leaders who really should be sort of saying, we should be aspiring to a world that is this, this, and this. Leaders that pander to the lowest common denominator.
Now, you've started a youth empowerment initiative in Australia. What's that about?
So Youth Without Borders is an organization I started when I was 16, actually. It was about getting young people to work together on projects that positively changed their communities. It was a really sort of grassroots organization, and now it's turned into a group that really is about empowering young people to realize their full potential. And we do that through collaborative community-based projects. So that means that young people come up with an idea that, you know, impacts their community, and we help make that happen. So whether it is a football camp or an engineering camp or a leadership program or simply fundraising for something they care about, we try to provide the support to make that happen. And so it's about young people realizing they can make a difference in the world. And our members tend to be low socioeconomic asylum seekers, refugees, and so on. Young people who would usually
not necessarily be told or not necessarily be see their world reflected in the current leadership and showing them that they can be those leaders.
And what about the situation of the Aboriginal population?
Asking all the tough questions, yeah. It's, again, the Indigenous situation in Australia. I will actually say that I feel like the language or the Indigenous populations in Australia, we're starting to hear more and more from them in the public space. And that's because some leaders within the Indigenous community or some individuals who have kind of made it within the Indigenous community are deciding that, you know, they are going to become increasingly public and increasingly demanding. Because the reality is that for an average Indigenous person, they will likely live 17 years less. They will likely be incarcerated. They will, like, there's the situation for an Indigenous person in Australia is so much worse than for anybody else living in Australia. And a good friend of mine once said to me, I was talking about how for a migrant, Australia was a place of hope. She was like, yes, but that hope doesn't extend to the First Peoples of this nation.
In Europe, this, in the wake of neoliberalization and increasing income inequality, there's been a rise of right-wing parties in Holland, Austria, Hungary, the UK, other places. Is that happening in Australia as well?
Yes. They don't yet have the power that they do in Europe. Life is still pretty good in Australia, like comparatively to Europe. And so even though those kind of parties do exist and are kind of gaining some traction, and we've got, you know, the likes of Pauline Hanson, who's someone who sort of came up in the late 90s on a platform of sort of anti-Asian migration, has literally come out about a week after Donald Trump said something ridiculous again, you know, came out with a video that said, well, you know, Muslims are the problem, Islam is the problem, we shouldn't be allowing any Muslims into the country, the same sort of rhetoric that you see from the likes of Donald Trump and those in Europe. What I'm hoping is that the more liberal movement or the more progressive movements in Australia move quickly enough, because I think what's happened in Europe and the United States is this kind of complacency around, well, this can't possibly be a thing. Like, we can't possibly, you know, I think the same reflects on what we've seen with Brexit. This can't possibly happen. But I think believing this can't possibly happen and allowing the language that we're seeing to proliferate is what led to the Second World War. You know, it's what led to historically all sorts of conflict, that deep entrenched conflict. And so, yes, it's happening in Australia, but I'm hopeful that it won't stick. But who knows?
Now, you were born in Sudan. Do you have any connections with that country?
Yeah, so most of my family still lives in Sudan or Egypt, and we used to go back every 2 years and as a family, and I still sort of maintain that kind of constant connection. I spent about half a year with my grandma after I graduated from university just to kind of rekindle that connection with the country as an adult as well. And I think I will always, I'll always owe something to Sudan. I mean, at the end of the day, I was born in the desert, you know, I really was. I was born in a desert in a country that didn't offer me the opportunities my parents felt would allow me to realize my potential. So we left, but I will always feel connected to Sudan.
I mean, dealing with these issues of misogyny and racism and anti-Muslim bias, do you ever feel overwhelmed?
It definitely... Every once in a while, I think, gosh, life is tough, huh? But I also have it really, really good. Like, I am so blessed that I, A, have the platform to be able to speak to someone like yourself, you know, be able to travel and to talk about issues and to be heard. Now, that is something that many, many people don't have the opportunity to. I've had education, I've had parents that allowed me the support or provided the support for me to get to where I am. So I can't allow myself to despair, because if I despair, where does that leave those with so much less privilege than I? You know, I'm in a position where, yes, the times may be despairing, but we have to kind of keep looking ahead and we have to believe, really keep the faith that things will get better. Inshallah, all will be well.
And if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I just turned 25.
Very old.
I feel like you know, I'm pretty much over the hill.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
That was Yasmin Abdul-Majid on Recognizing Bias. She spoke in Ottawa at the convention of the National Union of Public and General Employees, one of Canada's largest trade unions. I interviewed her after her talk. Yasmin Abdul-Majid is an activist and organizer. She was named 2015 Queensland Young Australian of the Year. She's the author of Yasmin's Story. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Ralph Nader, Naomi Klein, David Suzuki, Thomas Frank, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, and Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Yasmin Abdul-Majid on Recognizing Bias, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to James Clancy and Len Bush. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.